where Norwalk comes for news and talk. The Lisa Wexler Show, now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
By way of background, welcome back to the show. You're listening to WICC here at AM 600, but also on 107.3 FM. Check us out on FM. We may be in your listening area, and then we have a little bit of a different timber to our voice. We love the feedback. 203-333-9422. In my other life, as you know, I'm the probate judge for the Westport Weston District, and I have the benefit now and then of getting updates on our new laws, particularly as they impact what I do as a judge. Joining us right now is Professor Douglas Nee Jame, who is a professor of law at Yale Law School with a distinguished career in writing and research with respect to looking at the laws of this country, with respect to gender equality in the law, gender identity in the law, sexuality and how that's been presented in the law. Even in 2014, writing an article called Before Marriage, The Unexplored History of Non-Marital Recognition and Its Relationship to Marriage. And, you know, the extent to which our law changes and evolves is the extent to which our society changes and evolves. We have a brand new law in Connecticut called the Parentage Act. So joining us now is this professor who is largely responsible, I understand, for literally writing the law, not passing it, but writing it, and has been very active in teaching it so that the rest of us understand what the new law is going to be. Professor Nee Jame, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today, and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. So first of all, tell us the basics. It's the Parentage Act. Is that correct? Not the Parenting Act, the Parentage Act?
Yes, the Parentage Act. And the main purpose of the act is to update Connecticut's laws, which really have not been updated in decades with respect to parentage. And parentage is just the legal parent-child relationship. So most people just take it for granted that they're legal parents of their children, but may be surprised to learn that some people in Connecticut don't have that legal relationship recognized, even though they're the person parenting their child and everyone in their community understands them to be the parent of the child. And so this updates our laws so that our laws really reflect the families that are living in our state.
So, Professor, 203-333-9422, if you've got a question about this, one of the startling changes for the layman would be the fact that the words mother and father have been eliminated from the law. We're no longer referring to parents as either a mother or father. Is that correct?
Yes. So we, going forward, come January 1, our law will just use the term parent and parentage rather than mother, father, maternity, paternity. And it makes sense given what we've been doing in the past several years in Connecticut because, so for instance, consider a same-sex couple. When the woman gives birth, we have begun to treat her spouse as a legal parent of the child. But under our laws, it still says mother, father, husband, wife. And so it really doesn't reflect where we've come as a state. And so now our law would be clear that instead of saying the man married to the woman who gives birth is a legal father, our law says the individual married to the person who gives birth is a legal parent.
Okay. So with that, so that's going to be for certain generations and certain people, sort of a startling change in the law. But I understand what you're saying about that makes sense given the history of Connecticut being very progressive with respect to recognizing gay marriage. And so, so I understand that. Now, tell us a little bit substantively, Professor Nee Jame, about what else does the Parentage Act do? What else does it do that people you think need to know?
Yeah, so the most important thing from my perspective is really how it deals with non-biological parents, and that includes parents in same-sex couples. Obviously, same-sex couples often have one person who's the biological parent and one person who's not. But that also matters for a lot of other families who have children through assisted reproduction. And Connecticut actually has the second highest rate of assisted reproduction in the country, second to Massachusetts. And Fairfield County has the highest rate of assisted reproduction in Connecticut. So there's a lot of families who, you know, same-sex couples, different-sex couples, single women, who are having children through assisted reproduction, meaning they're using donor sperm or they're using in vitro fertilization. Some might be using donor eggs. Some might be engaging in surrogacy. And under our existing laws, we actually didn't include a lot of those families. And so there were a lot of folks in Connecticut who, if they had a child through assisted reproduction, and let's say they used donor sperm, if they weren't married, the second parent, let's say it's a heterosexual couple, they're unmarried, woman gives birth, they use donor sperm, the man wouldn't be treated as a parent unless he adopted the child. Same thing is true of same-sex couples, and that's why a lot of same-sex couples are adopting their children in the probate court. And so now, going forward, what the law says is a person who consents to assisted reproduction with the intent to be a parent of the child is a parent of the child. And that really aligns with how people in the state understand parent-child relationships. And if for folks who are going through assisted reproduction, I know the providers in Fairfield County treat the individuals as parents. If a couple comes in and they're going through the process, the doctors and nurses treat them as they're both parents. And so it's surprising to learn sometimes that they're not actually treated by the law as parents, and that the second parent can't actually get on the birth certificate without adopting the child. And so going forward, come January 1, that's no longer going to be a problem. And now both of the individuals will be treated as parents. And the other really important thing is that they will be able to establish their parentage through a simple form called an acknowledgement of parentage. And so right now in Connecticut, when a woman gives birth to a child in the hospital, if she's unmarried, she's given an acknowledgement of paternity, and she can fill that out with the man who says he's the biological father, and that establishes his parentage. And that's actually the most common way in the whole country in which parentage is established for children born to unmarried women. Going forward, our acknowledgement of paternity is now going to be an acknowledgement of parentage, and it's going to be able to be signed by couples who use assisted reproduction to establish parentage for the non-biological parent.
We're chatting with Professor Douglas Nee James, 203-333-9422. You know, I have a question a little bit about some of the social engineering policy that's behind some of this, Professor. And I'm going to posit, just for purposes of conversation, a little bit of pushback in terms of the separation of the acknowledgement of parenting versus the biological reality of both these egg donors and sperm donors. Because I wonder, thinking about the best interests of children going forward, I have many people in my own life and my personal life, nieces actually, who found out later in life that they were children of assisted reproductive technology, but it was a big secret. They didn't know. Mm-hmm. And that was because the father's sperm count was low, who they thought was their father, who is their father. You know what I'm saying? But in any event, the parents decided that they would go to a sperm donor. And then what happens in life, and then the parents get divorced. This is in two cases. And so the child didn't grow up with the close familial relationship of their father every single day. And although there was an attachment, there was also a curiosity later in life about, well, who is this person who biologically contributed to my life, right? I mean, who is my biological parent? And I was just startled at the extent to which, and please tell me if I'm getting it wrong, but I was just startled to the extent to which sperm donors and egg donors are just completely, you know, not counted as parents for any way, shape, or form. Now, I know they don't have a duty to support, and I know in many cases they want to be anonymous, but there's still a biological reality for the child that's born. And I'm just wondering how you've thought about that.
Yeah, so actually this is the subject of my own research and writing, and I'm fascinated by it. So there are a lot of studies on donor-conceived children. And we know that donor-conceived children often have a curiosity about whoever the sperm or egg donor was. And we also know that more problematic situations arise when there isn't openness with the child around being donor-conceived. It's actually similar to what we see in adoption. And now there's, in adoption, such a push around open adoption. And it was really secrecy that produces issues. And we see that in donor conception as well. Under our current law, there are no parental roles assigned to egg donors or sperm donors. But what this law does is actually provide more regulation so that children who are donor conceived have more rights to actually get information. So right now, there's not much regulation. And there's not regulation at the federal level or the state level. But one part of this law that people haven't paid much attention to, and partly because it doesn't affect the courts, is the law that the part that regulates what we call fertility clinics and gamete banks. And it provides that they have to provide medical information to the families and to donor-conceived children when they request it, but also that they have to make efforts to provide personal identifying information about the donor. And even if the donor has requested anonymity at the time of donation, the bank has an obligation to go back to the donor if the child requests information to ask whether they could make that information available. And personally, and I think this is the best practice among gamete banks, in a world of 23andMe and all of the information that's available, it is not responsible to guarantee anonymity to a donor. And
I
so
agree.
It's better to have a system of regulation so that we can actually have records and people can have access to them. And so I think you're going to see that trend just as we've seen with adoption, where people have more access to information about their donors, even though their donors are clearly not parents, they're not parenting them. And you know, we, as you said, attachment, the attachment relationship is with the person who's the parent. But the child might have lots of reasons that they eventually want information about the sperm or egg donor.
Well, I think you could argue in a way it's a civil right, the way we've opened up finally our adoption laws in Connecticut. I think it was a long time overdue. I think you could argue it's a civil right to know where you came from, period, end. Like, I just think it is, actually. You know, it's arguably
yeah, I think
a civil
that,
right
that,
to know.
That conversation is still evolving here. But if, I mean, my view is if we know that children eventually want this information, then how do we go about regulating in a way that provides that? And certainly the adoption setting, we've seen now the overwhelming consensus that children should have access to information about their birth parents.
Their birth parents, exactly. We're chatting with Professor Douglas Neejame of Yale Law School, 203-333-9422, about the brand new Parentage Act in Connecticut that will become effective in January. Can you tell us, Professor, what are the circumstances under this new law in which a child can legally now have three parents?
Yes. So this actually, I mean, it sort of ties to the question you raised about biological parents. So right now in Connecticut, let's say there is a situation in which a husband and wife are together and wife has a child, but she has a child conceived through an extramarital sexual relationship. But she and the husband raise the child together. And then eventually the child also forms a relationship with the genetic father. Those cases arise. We actually have a Connecticut Supreme Court case on that from a couple decades ago. And under our current law, the child can only have two parents. And so the courts have said, well, the court has to decide what's in the best interest. And is it for the genetic father or the husband to be legally recognized? And under the law come January 1, a court has authority, at least, to decide that if it would be detrimental to the child, which is a higher standard than best interest, more like harmful to the child, not to recognize the third parent, then the court can decide that the child has three parents. And so that's most common in the situation in which you have husband and wife, but there's a different genetic father. But you could see it in other situations as well, in which someone has two legal parents, but let's say those legal parents are not able to care for the child, and another person, let's say aunt, becomes the parent of the child, and really from the child from a young age is raising the child. Child views the person as their parent, but aunt wants to be recognized as a parent with decision-making authority and all of that, but doesn't want to terminate the rights of the existing parents. This would allow for that situation as well. So it really could include lots of different kinds of families, some that seem very conventional and some that don't.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because right now the situations in which it comes up in my court as a probate judge are situations in which the law handles it by naming typically a grandparent the guardian. So the grandparent's the guardian. But honestly, that role of guardian for some of these grandparents that I'm thinking of a couple of cases is less than satisfactory for them. They would like to be considered to be the parent. They are the parent in every meaningful way, but they don't want to have to terminate parental rights of mothers and fathers because that creates where I, as a judge, have to make findings of complete abandonment. And sometimes the fact patterns don't suggest that at all. The other parents are a little bit involved. They haven't completely abandoned their child, but the child is in fact parented by more than two people.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of situation that now I would expect, at least in some cases, that grandparent could be adjudicated, could be determined to be what we call a de facto parent in the new law, because they formed that parent-child relationship. And, you know, most grandparents are grandparents, and that's their role. But there are some grandparents who actually are parents of children.
That's right. That's right. We're chatting with Professor Douglas Nee James, 203-333-9422. I have one more question for you, Professor. Can you explain what Connecticut's view is with respect to, in the Parentage Act, surrogacy in general? And the reason I raise this is because in India, you know, they used to be a place that was where many people came, many American families came and did surrogacy. And I, as a probate judge, saw several of these surrogacy contracts come to my court. And then in a belt and suspenders approach, the non-biological parent adopted the child, even though in one case the parent was on the birth certificate. Anyway, but they did this because in India they banned surrogacy and they were worried about the legal enforceability of these documents. The reason they banned surrogacy is because they felt as a public policy matter that it encouraged too much exploitation of poor women. You're somebody who's given a lot of thought to this. And I would like to know your thoughts on how the law deals with surrogacy. What is Connecticut's public policy towards surrogacy? And how do we not exploit poor women for their uteri? How do we not exploit them for that?
I'm so glad you situated in that, because I think the question for us as a society is not do we allow or ban surrogacy, because people are doing it and they're going to do it and they're going to do it in jurisdictions that allow it, including traveling to other countries. And so for me, the question is, how do we make surrogacy a practice that is available and regulated in ways that respects the interests of the various participants? And that includes the women who are acting as surrogates. And so Connecticut actually had allowed surrogacy for more than a decade now. There was a Connecticut Supreme Court decision in 2011 that recognized that the courts could decide that the intended parents are the legal parents. And so gestational surrogacy in Connecticut had been happening, and New York had banned it until 2020. So many couples from New York were coming to Connecticut. In that Connecticut Supreme Court decision in 2011, the court pleaded with the legislature to pass regulations to deal with the practice. And so what this act does is it actually provides comprehensive regulation representing best practices from around the country as to how to regulate surrogacy. And we did it in consultation with leading doctors and providers at ethics boards, the assisted reproduction professional organizations, so that we actually provide, for the first time under Connecticut law, rights for the women who serve as surrogates. So, for instance, I mean, you've probably seen in those surrogacy agreements, there's often clauses that require the surrogate to undergo an abortion if requested by the intended parents. Our law now says that that's not enforceable and is void against public policy. The law will also require that the surrogate have independent legal counsel in the arrangement, paid for by the intended parents, but the obligations of the lawyer run to the surrogate, that the surrogate has the right to refuse a cesarean section that's not medically necessary, has the right to refuse a multiple embryo transfer, which we know is more dangerous than a single embryo transfer. So really is trying to say, here are the things that are required to enter into a surrogacy arrangement, and they include protection for the rights of the person who's the surrogate. And we didn't have that before January 1.
Thank you. So, Professor Douglas Nijame, I really thank you for coming on the show today and giving us this comprehensive summary. I know you've just touched on some of it. You gave us a 3-hour talk and you could have gone on another 3 hours. There's a lot to it, but I think we've touched on some of the highlights, and I think we're doing a public service to let people know that there is this sea change going on in January. And so for families that are potentially families that would need to know about what the law is with respect to assisted reproductive technology and in general about how Connecticut is now viewing people who are parents. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you getting the word out. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Yale Professor Douglas Nijame on the Lisa Wexler Show. We're going to be having this as a featured podcast today. You'll be able to hear it on WICC600.com after the show, as well as on SoundCloud and on the Lisa Wexler Show on iTunes. We'll be right back.